Okay, good evening, everyone. Welcome back. We're broadcasting live. October 14th, 2015. So we have more Dhammapada. This one we have three verses. So let's get started. Hello and welcome back to our study of the Dhammapada. Tonight we continue on with verses 87 to 89, which read as follows. Kanhang dhammang vipahaya sukhang bhaveta pandito oka anokama gamma vivekeya taduramang tatra biratimicheya hitva kame akinchano Paryodapeya attanang cittaklesehi pandito Yesang sambodhi angesu samajittang subhavitang Adana patinissage anupadaya yerata Kina savajutimanto teloke parinibhuta. So three verses. The meaning of which is as follows. Giving up or abandoning black dhammas, vipahaya. Sukhang bhavita pandito, a wise one cultivates white dhammas, cultivates the white. Oka anokama gamma. Viveka yataduramang. Having gone from home to homelessness, one dwells in a solitude that is hard to enjoy, difficult to enjoy. And then the next verse, tatra birati micheya. One should wish for great enjoyment or appreciation of such happiness. Having hitva kame akinchino, having destroyed or cut off sensuality. Akinchino means as one who has nothing. Paryodapeya attanang. One should cleanse or purify oneself. Cittaklesehi pandito. As a wise one should cleanse the mind, one's own mind, of all defilements. Yesang sambodhi angesu. Samajitang subhavitang. One who has well cultivated one's own mind rightly in regards to the sambodhi anga, the anga, the factors relating to enlightenment. Adana patinisage, having abandoned clinging, anupadaya yerata, who dwells happy without clinging. Kinasava, who has destroyed the taints or the stains of one's mind. Jutimanto, one who is brilliant. Te loke parinibhuta, such a one becomes completely calmed or tranquilized or extinguished in the world. So quite a bit. This is, again, as I said, a part of this famous set of verses, or well known in Thailand anyway. It's something that we chant quite often. I haven't chanted it in a while, but still quite familiar. And as it happens, there is no story to go with these verses. There's only the story that we have is of 50 monks who came to see the Buddha, from Kosala. And the kingdom of Kosala, 50 monks came to see the Buddha. And when they got there, the Buddha asked them and had them relate to him the things that went on or their goings on. And then that was it. He taught them this verse. So this is just simply an example of teaching the Dhamma. So now my job is to explain this Dhamma. That's really the key here, because this is one verse that has quite a bit of pith to it, quite a bit of meaning to it. There's quite a bit in here, so let's try and break it into pieces and relate it to our practice. Kanhang Dhamma, the black Dhammas. So we have this black and white. This is common, I guess you could say, imagery that the Buddha used. Black refers to the bad, and white refers to the good. I have a friend who many years ago asked me about this. He said, so did the Buddha have a problem with black, you know? This friend of mine was dark-skinned, African heritage. And so he asked me, he said, did the Buddha have a problem with black, with the color black? I mean, why do meditators wear white? And the idea is that white is about purity. It has something to do with purity. But it's quite a charged statement and a charged tradition. Because in India, you know, the idea of light skin was associated with higher caste, or it's actually unclear whether that was truly the case, but there is some sense of that, especially I think after the British were colonized and controlled the country for so long, it seems they may have promoted the idea. But, you know, my response to him was that, well, I mean, it has nothing to do with skin color, because white skin would look, no one has white skin and no one has black skin. There's no such thing. We all have various shades of, you know, from pink to tan, I guess. And this is just it's more to do with light and dark, lightness and darkness. Black is just a word. It's not that the Buddha liked the color white more than the color black, but there is suitable imagery that corresponds with it, because white is associated with light, which you can use to see, right? Black is associated with darkness, which implies the inability to see and the corresponding problems and difficulties. But here it refers to evil and good. So one should give up evil and cultivate good. Destroy evil in one's heart and cultivate the good. So we're talking about unwholesome bodily acts and acts of speech and unwholesome states of mind. And then we're talking about their opposites when we refer to the white. So wholesome deeds of action and speech and wholesome thoughts. So the first two are in regards to morality. The third one is in regards to concentration and wisdom. But this is how it starts. You know, we start by somehow monitoring our body and our speech and watching our movements. This is how meditation starts, right? We start by looking at the body, and it may not be clear, but simply watching the stomach rising and falling is an example of morality. Doesn't seem like it's an ethical thing. It's an ethically charged thing to do, but it actually is. It's an ethically sound action, which sounds kind of funny, but it's an action. Watching your stomach rise and fall is an action that is free from any unethical or violations of ethics from a Buddhist point of view. When you walk, stepping right, stepping left, you have ethics, and you're monitoring your actions. And by doing that, I mean, the extension is that when you're doing sitting or walking meditation in this way, you're less likely to commit an infraction, or, you know, you're less likely to commit an act or a speech that is unwholesome, not simply because it's a ritualistic movement. That's more to do with protecting you while you're training, but also because you're mindful. And the point is you're cultivating mindfulness so that then when you take that out into the ordinary world, you'll be able to apply it so that when a mosquito lands on your arm, you won't immediately react by killing, by attacking. So, you know, that's, I mean, from the very get-go, that's what meditation is all about. And then later on, it begins to affect your mind, begins to change so that you don't even want to kill, want to hurt, want to do these such things. You're more inclined to do good things, to help people, as you see how it brings peace and happiness and how it's just a more efficient and productive thing to do. Do good deeds. Oka no kama gamma. So going from home to homelessness. This is obviously a big part of the Buddhist monastic path. Now it's not for everyone, but here he is talking to monks, and it is considered a great thing to do. You could also look at this sort of, I guess, symbolically, because it refers to, oka is an interesting word. You could think of it simply as going from owning things to not owning things, in the sense of not letting things own you, not identifying with your possessions, because obviously monks would live in huts, and they nowadays live in even houses, or some monks live in apartment buildings and that kind of thing. So it's not the case that they don't have a dwelling. It's that they don't have anything that they call their own. And lay people can do this as well, not in the sense of legally giving up the right to things, but mentally and in terms of the ego, giving up one's attachment to things and using things, not having things own you in that sense. And as a result of this, one attains a solitude. One's mind isn't constantly flitting off to one's belongings. It's hard to find such solitude. The Buddha said hard to enjoy. And he uses this word often, because most of us would like possessions, right? And are obsessed with our possessions and getting more possessions and protecting and maintaining and even just looking at and touching and using our possessions. It's hard to enjoy the solitude of giving things up. Akinchano, which we see in verse number 88, being with nothing. Akinchano means someone who has nothing. It could be in regards to physical possessions, it could be in regards to mental attachments. So he says, tatrabhi rati micheya, one should strive for, one should wish for. It is worth wanting, in a sense, such a sense of enjoyment, enjoying being at peace. Hitwa kami, having destroyed kama, having destroyed sensual pleasure, sensual desire, the attachment to sensual pleasure, the objects of sensual pleasure, having given them up. And giving up and purifying one's mind of defilements. This is what a wise one does. You notice the pattern of the talk about a wise one, right? This whole chapter is the Pandita Vagga, which with these three verses we've now finished. But this is how the Dhammapada is set up. Each chapter is associated by the mention of a certain specific word. So there's, I think, 22 chapters, 20-some, more than 22, I think, 20-some chapters, and 423 verses. And we've just finished the sixth vagga, the sixth chapter, which is the Pandita chapter. Anyway, so we're clear in our minds in this tradition, in the Buddha's tradition, that clinging to things is a problem. And that if we can be free from such clinging, if we can come to just live without this clinging, then we would be free from suffering, that this would be a better thing. And so the Buddha in 88, he gives a description, it's just a very brief description of how we go about this, and this is by cleansing our minds of the attachment. So the answer is not to always get what you want, it's to stop wanting. To stop wanting for things. Clear your mind of defilements. Clear your mind of the things that make you want this and want that, or make you hate this or hate that. And this is our practice in meditation. So we're constantly working on this. We're not concerned about what we get or don't get. And we look at we watch our minds, observe our minds, monitor our minds as we get and as we lose, and as change comes to us again and again. We work out these mental states, slowly changing and purifying our minds. This is the practice. This is the Buddha's exhortation to these 50 monks. And then finally, 89 gives more details we have in regards to the Anga of the Sambodhi, the factors of enlightenment. This could be the Bojanga, or it could also be the Bodhipakkhya Dhamma. Probably, I think the commentary says it's the seven Bojangas. So it means cultivating the Bojangas, which, if you don't know what those are, we have Sati. Starts with, of course, Sati, which is the ability to remember or remind yourself, the remembrance of things as they are, seeing things as they are, not how you wish them to be, or how you like them to be, not based on liking or disliking, not judging them or extrapolating upon them. And then with Sati you have Dhammavicaya, which means this investigation that goes on, or not investigation, but more like starting to categorize and separate and to figure out, to understand dhammas, let's put it that way, to understand reality. So as we meditate and we cultivate sati, we start to see the difference between right and wrong. We start to see what we're doing wrong. We start to change our habits naturally. Our minds start to change as we see how we're causing ourselves suffering. It's like, that's not useful. If I continue that, it's going to cause me suffering. Better that I change that. And it's not even intellectual. It's just naturally, through the observation, through monitoring and seeing what we're doing right and wrong, we're able to change. So this is Dhammavicaya. And then there's Virya, which is effort. This helps us put out effort, and we also have to put out effort. Putting out effort is important. You have to work at it. And you have to constantly bring your mind back to the present moment. Bring your mind back to reality again and again and again. It's something that has to become habitual. You have to cultivate the habit, and you have to work at it. So that's Virya. Then Piti. Piti means you have to be, you have to have some kind of stimulation in a sense, you have to be into it. You have to get into a groove, and you have to work at getting into a routine and a groove and getting caught up so that it just becomes natural. And pasati is tranquility. Part of the practice is to calm the mind. The mind becomes calmer as you sort things out in your mind. And then samadhi is concentrated. The mind becomes focused and concentrated, seeing things clearly, not superficially, and not being distracted by everything that comes along. And finally, upekkha. The mind eventually gets to a state where it sees everything just as it is. The judgments fade away, and the mind is simply noting experience after experience after experience. So all seven of these are the seven Bojangas that the Buddha is talking about. And it's a really good, simple explanation of the various things that we have to cultivate in our practice. And this is called Sammacittang Subhavitang, the right cultivation good, well-cultivated mind, well and rightly cultivated mind, more or less. Adana patinisa ge, one should give up clinging. So it all comes back to our clinging. What do we mean by judgments? We mean our inability to adapt and to keep up with change, basically. You know, things change, something comes or something goes, and we cling to what it was or what it is. So it is right now, and that rather than roll with it and change, we want for it to change, either to get closer to it or to get farther away from it. We want it to come, or we want it to stay, or we want it to go. And that's called clinging. And that's what we're giving up. So the Buddha says we give this up and dwell happily without it. Kina asava, having destroyed the asava, the various taints, which relates back to the defilements that we already talked to. So it's talked about. So it's desire for sensuality, desire for becoming, you know, wanting to be this, wanting to be that. Thoughts that arise, hey, it'd be great if I was boss or something like that, president or whatever. And then views of self and so on, all of these things that cloud our mind or cloud our judgment. Jutimanto, brilliant, because one is full of wisdom. As one practices, one comes to understand oneself and by extension, really, the whole universe. And that's a sort of a brilliance. Such a person becomes free. So as a result, it's not just a static state where, okay, now I know, now I understand reality, now what? It's not static, because once you understand reality, you let it go. And that's how cessation comes about. That's how the experience of nirvana or nibbana comes about. And eventually that's how one frees oneself from the rounds of samsara, being born old, sick, and dying. And that's what is meant by parinibbuta. One frees oneself from the cycle that we find ourselves trapped in. So that's all. These are teachings for us to remember. It's like one of those quotables of the Buddha, something you could quote. Although, as you can see by the translation, it's not easy to be literal and to quote this literally. But there are some good translations of the Dhammapada out there, so anyway, I'm just trying to get the sense across and give some interesting teachings. So we have several in here. And at the heart of it are the seven Bojangas, which is now explained in brief. So that's the teaching on the Dhammapada today. Thank you all for tuning in. Wishing you all the best, and keep practicing. All right, that's that. Do we have any questions?
We do.
Good.
Is a Pacheka Buddha just like a self-taught arahant, or are they more than that?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think all Pacheka Buddhas will be exactly the same, but that's about the gist of it. I mean, it's not just, because it takes a lot to become a Pacheka Buddha, but that's, you know, the definition.
Arahants are always happy, correct? Is it simply that their happiness, or is it simply that their happiness is not dependent on anything?
I mean, happiness is a difficult word. Do you mean they always experience a happy feeling? No. No, that's not the case. But are they always at peace? I would say that's a better description. The answer is yes. On the other hand, they have physical suffering, but it's only physical. They have no mental suffering until they attain final nirvana, and then there's no physical suffering as well.
to meditation question, every few minutes my eyes would feel painful, and after saying pain, pain, pain for a bit, tears would flow out of them. Is this a common experience? That doesn't usually happen to me.
Yeah, it can be related to what we call piti, cry, tears is common in that sense. It can come from concentration, but the body does strange things. It's showing you what my teacher would say. He said, you see that? You know what that tells you? Impermanence. That when you said that this hasn't, he'll say, do you feel, does it feel strange? Who's it back, me? He'll say. And he said, ka, ka, anichang. Impermanence. That's really it, you know. It's the sense of strangeness, like, oh, it never happened to me before, is helping cultivate this sense of flexibility that is an important part of insight meditation. So that sense of flexibility is going to be important in terms of, it's an important part of the progress, and it's going to increase as you get further on. You're going to be surprised and thrown off guard, and the practice is to cultivate the flexibility to be able to just see the new experience as it is rather than reacting to it.
Bhante, what is the cause of dullness? How can dullness of mind be eliminated, and how can it be prevented from arising in the future? I ask this question because I am a student and sometimes find that my mind is dull.
Yeah, I mean, well, sometimes the brain just gets overworked, but there's a mental aspect. That's what we would call sloth and torpor. It's old English terms that don't really mean all that much. Probably should update those because no one uses words like sloth and torpor, although torpor's a good one. I think some people have tried to update it, but we're pretty much stuck with sloth and torpor. It's the physical and the mental, I guess more it's considered the mental hindrance of a stiffness in the mind. I mean, the only way to really overcome it is through mindfulness. That's the only surefire way. But sometimes it's, as I said, can be physical, can be organic. Either way, it's not something that you can just do away with and have it never come back. And that's not our goal in meditation. I mean, that's not our practice in meditation. Ultimately, it will go away and never come back. That's great. But, in the meantime, that's not our immediate goal. Our goal is to see it clearly as it is. We're not worried if it comes or if it goes, if it stays or if it goes. We're just concerned with seeing it as it is, so you can acknowledge dull, dull, or feeling. Just remind yourself that's all it is, and stop wishing for it to go away.
Bhante, is sloth on the physical side and torpor on the mental side?
No, they're both mental. I think it's, I mean, the commentary does funny things like this, but, you know, it's interesting. It says tina, I think, is the mind, is in the mind, and midda is in the mental concomitants. You have to look it up in the Abhidhamma exactly what it means, but it's, you know, I don't know. They get so technical sometimes. But they're both mental. Neither one is considered physical.
Okay, thank you. Bhante, good evening, and thank you for your time. This evening, after my meditation timer sounded, the end of my meditation session, it startled me. I noted my reaction as startled. My question is, since I was startled, does that tell me I was not practicing correctly? Thank you.
Could be, yeah. I mean, there is one stage of knowledge where the meditator becomes acutely aware of such things, almost to the point of paranoia, but anything will set them off. Like, they'll look at, the classic example is they'll look at their bed and be freaked out. Like, they'll get a sense of just extreme fear by looking at a simple object. There's reasons for that, and it's a specific stage of knowledge. And it can come, you know, I mean, people can get this sense of, it has to do with seeing everything cease and just getting worked up and worked up about it. It's not actually a good thing, but it's a side effect of experiencing knowledge and understanding and not being able to react to it. So in the beginning, this sort of jumpiness can come. Often a meditator in that jnana will feel as if they're falling over and freak and just jump, like as though they suddenly fall into this feeling that they're about to fall. That's a common characteristic. But I mean, probably more common is just a general sense of jumpiness a good reason for it to come is distraction, right? When you're caught up in something and someone walks up behind you. We're not allowed to scare fellow monks. And when I went back to Stony Creek recently, I walked up behind the head monk and just stood there watching him. Oh boy, did I scare him. And I felt really bad because, you know, knowing his history and what he's been through in his life, scaring him is not very nice. So yeah, you have to be careful to make your presence known. But yeah, it happens. That sort of thing happens. So, I mean, whatever, it's an experience, and the correct response is to acknowledge the fear or the feeling or whatever is in the present moment.
Hello, Bhante. If I help someone out and they pay me for it, is there still good karma? Thanks.
Karma is momentary, so every moment you're creating karma. That's why mindfulness is so important. So karma isn't one big deed that you did. In fact, after you do the deed, what you think about it is more karma. So if you're worried about was it good karma or was it bad karma, well, that's more karma. If you feel happy about helping someone, that's good karma. If you feel happy about the money you made, that's kind of, well, probably more on the greed side. At the moment when you took the person's money, there may have been greed as well. Economics is very, very, of course, it's very subtle and not something that's going to lead you to hell or anything, but most economic transactions are greed-based. You know, when you write up someone a bill, I would say there's a fairly likely unwholesomeness associated with that. But it's, you know, it's very minor and very small. It's just, this is why an anagami can't do it. They can't charge people. There was this anagami who just sat by the side of the road and said, take what you want and leave what you think it's worth. Because he couldn't put a price tag or tell people, you must pay this or this is how much. He just said, you know, take it and help me live so I can, you know, basically what a monk would say. Speaking of, tomorrow I'm going for alms. My first alms round since I've been here anyway. So, I think they just called, actually. Let me see. Oh no, someone else. I think it's the Vietnamese monk in Toronto. Anyway, I'll call him back later. But she called tonight, and they live downtown. It's this Laotian family, couple. And we were talking about it, and they said, oh no, I don't want to. We don't want to make it hard on you. And I said, but this is the way the Buddha would have it. So it's a proper thing to do, at least until it gets really cold. But tomorrow should be fine. So I'm going to take a bus downtown to her house, to their house, and bring my bowl and get food for the day. So that's kind of neat.
Bhante, in your booklet you mentioned that during walking meditation that we should keep our gaze 6 feet ahead of the body. I find this difficult to do and instead look at my feet as I'm stepping in order to stay more mindful. Is this wrong practice? Thanks, Bhante.
Yeah, there are problems with it. Again, tricks are not a good idea in general. There's no reason why looking 6 feet out should make it difficult to be mindful, except, you know, it probably does for many people because we're not accustomed to this. But like any training, it's something you just have to work at. It's better to keep your eyes away from the object. Otherwise, your mind is more focused on the eyes. You're not more mindful, you're just more focused, and it's not helpful for the practice. It's much more helpful to put your eyes somewhere where they're not gonna, you know, where they're not gonna get you in trouble. And that's really the best place, is 45 degree angle, because if you look up, well, they're gonna get you in trouble. And if you look down at your feet, again, they're gonna get you in trouble. So no, I wouldn't recommend it, and you're just gonna have to, I mean, we're always looking for tricks to how I can be more quote unquote mindful, but it doesn't make you more mindful. It's just a trick that makes you more focused, and that's not really useful. It makes you tricky. It makes you look for tricks. How I can make it easier. I'm not trying to make it easier. It's really hard, and that's, you know, that's a part of it. It's kind of like cheating, really. You have to do the difficult thing.
For an arahant, is physical suffering really suffering since you're not affected mentally?
I don't know. I mean, it depends how you look at it.
Is there a commentary for the Jatakas?
Yes. The Jataka, the commentary is the stories. Although there's also a word commentary, so I think it explains, yeah, there's an explanation of each of the verses, like word by word, just like with the Dhammapada. But those have never been translated either for the Dhammapada or the Jataka, because it's hard to translate. You're dealing with Pali etymology, and it's not really all that useful to translate a lot of it. But we do have the stories translated, and they're on sacred-texts.com.
Pantai, I have a Buddha image at home, and I want to know if there are any instructions on making an altar for it.
Not for me, no. I mean, there's Buddha images weren't even endorsed by the Buddha. He seems to have been against them, saying that they are only based on imagination, and they're problematic. So, yeah. On the other hand, I don't want to be hypocritical, because using a Buddha image was quite helpful for me when I was practicing. It seemed like it at the time. So it's useful for people who need that sort of thing, especially in the beginning of your practice. The Buddha didn't seem very interested in them. So, I mean, it just means there's no sense that we would ever have any instruction on how to build an altar.
There are some customs, though, like keeping it higher up, not putting it on the floor, that sort of
thing. Yep. Don't put it on a subway card. Sorry. I don't mean to pick on those people who did that, but it's just, yeah, getting back to that conversation about protocol. If you're going to have an image of the Buddha, it should be up pretty high.
Maybe the highest shelf or whatever.
Yeah.
One thing, how do you remove physical desires, such as the desire to eat or the desire to not feel physical pain?
Well, desire isn't physical. There may be physical manifestations of desire or corresponding mental brain states, etc., but they're not mental. So the desire itself is always mental. Oh, sorry, they're not desire. They are physical. Desire is mental. So the body's hunger response is not really hunger. It's just interpreted in that way by us. And it's been cultivated by us from lifetime after lifetime after lifetime. But all of that's neither here nor there. The more important is that though there is some implication in what you're saying, that perhaps you believe that being physical, they have nothing to do with meditation. But that's the point, is that there's a separation between one's actual desire to eat and the body's quote-unquote hunger response. Because one is just physical, and you just can say hungry, hungry, and it stays or it goes. But when you want to eat, that's a problem. And then you say wanting, wanting, and try to do away with that.
Would arahants scratch themselves?
I don't see why not. I mean, they wouldn't be disturbed by itches, but you know.
And with that, you're all caught up.
All right, let's run while we still can.
Thank you, Bhante.
Thank you, Robin. Have a good night, everyone.
Good evening.